The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly, and the greatest league in the world is back, and we were treated to non-stop action, or perhaps more accurately, stop action. We'll look back at the nice bits, Pogba's pass, Neto's volley, Roy's hair, but we'll also discuss anemic first halves, needless drinks breaks and some generally bad football matches. Is it the 3-month break? Is it the lack of fans? Or is football just not very good anymore? Was it ever good? We'll round up the other best league in the world, the Championship, as the Leeds burnout begins, and Philippe will make the lawyers work harder than a plinth ball boy as we give him the floor to talk about whatever he likes. Join us for an existential crisis where we question our life choices while aiming to make the analysis far more interesting than the football. All that on today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Philippe Auclair, bonjour.
Bonjour à toi.
Ça va bien?
Ça va bien. Et toi?
Muy bien. Barney Ronne, how are you?
I'm okay, Max. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. Nice to see you. Hey, Barry.
Mange too, Max. Mange too.
So, Barney, how did you feel about the... Before we get into the specifics of any one football match, how did you find the first full fixture list for 100 days?
Well, I mean, it's no secret, is it? It was understandably bad. It's football... Football suddenly become forever uninvolved, like the kind of job that most people have, where you go into work, watch the clock, mess around for a bit, hope some time passes, and then run out the door at 5 o'clock. It's become a day job. They're playing these games purely for the money. And I mean, obviously everyone does everything for the money, but now it's become urgently so. And also, you know, they're just not ready. They're not prepared. I didn't notice a lack of urgency or energy or effort, just that imperceptible thing where players, their combinations, the way they touch the ball, just not sharp. And I think we should all give them some slack over that. But having said that, it was just absolutely drainingly dull at times. It was an amazing experience purely for the extreme hard edge of that dullness. I mean, I was at West Ham and I found it extraordinary.
And how did it feel? I mean, for you, I mean, was there any difference? Because I would say that the boredom that we felt when we were watching it on TV screens, after, you know, switching from one channel to the next, wondering if you wanted fake crowd noise or just people saying "let go of the ball," from the stands or things like that, you were there, and it was no different.
It was really interesting. I have to say, West Ham, the stadium staff and the club, it was brilliant. It was really well organised and really well drilled, and everyone was really good. I went from this environment where you walk in and every single person is wearing not just like proper PPE, like face masks. They knew exactly what to do. They were really courteous and cheerful and brilliantly done. I felt this is the safest place in London. I walked out at the end and just across by the canal, there's 400 hipsters having a food market sat on next to each other, kind of yelling and drinking. And I thought, what is football's? Football gets a lot of flack. But I wanted to go back into West Ham where I felt safe.
Barry, can you inject some of your usual enthusiasm and joy to proceedings?
Well, I'm actually surprised you're all quite so down on it. I mean, there were some awful games. I think we're kind of looking from a different position from other punters. I mean, pretty much all I did all weekend was watch games of football, because I kind of have to, because I need to be able to talk about them on Monday morning. But other people don't do that. They dip in and they dip out. If a game is not very entertaining, they just switch it off and go and do something else. We're kind of compelled to watch them, whereas others aren't necessarily. But yeah, some of the games were awful. A lot of the first halves were conspicuously dreadful, which I suppose is understandable because it takes players a while to get going. But I didn't think it was quite as awful as you seem to have.
Probably the perception that we have as people who go to quite a lot of games in the flesh is bound to be completely different. Our reaction is going to be completely different from people who are used to enjoy the football through television. And the second thing is that perhaps it's shown that, I mean, we don't watch football usually. We watch the Premier League And on this occasion, now we're watching football. And actually, quite a few of us are perhaps realizing we don't like watching football too much.
There are some good new things, like I quite like the video wall of fans' faces celebrating things that suddenly pops up. But that's kind of enjoyable because you see all these people celebrating, and you know the same people are going to be in agonies moments later or later in the game. It gives a very personal touch to the feelings of Schadenfreude and gloating that we all like to bring to football. It's nice to put faces to these feelings. I also like the fake crowd noise. I think it's quite fun. I mean, I'm probably alone in that. It's always slightly off kilter. It's not been done that well. I mean, but there's something really enjoyable about hearing those totally vague crowd sounds that aren't actually people shouting about football, but kind of sound like they could be. I want the job of the guy who presses the button because they're really not doing it as they could.
You know what we're going to do? We're going to end up knowing who is actually doing the crowd noises for each game. We're going to have our favorite DJs.
Yes.
Or, you know, say, hey, we shouldn't miss this one. It's that guy is really, really good. It's like, he really, you know, you're not fit to referee. He knows exactly when to play it.
They think it sounds really sarcastic. They always have a really loud, ooh, when someone heads the ball miles over. But you need a button with just, there's always one guy who just goes, fuck off. Back off! I want to be the guy who presses that button over and over again, about 140 right. times during the game.
Let's talk about the game. The Spurs Man United game, I think, was the best game of the weekend. The introduction of Pogba was great for Manchester United, and you know he played that one pass to Marcus Rashford that was absolutely glorious, and he changed that football match, didn't he, Barney?
Yeah, and they've got. It's a shame for Man United because they were starting to get going, and they do have, you know, for the first time in quite a while, you look at the team just at the team list and think, actually, that's a really interesting team with some good players. It doesn't have obvious and the three man midfield of when he's back properly of Pogba, McTominay, and Bruno Fernandes, I think is really intriguing. I like all of those players, and I think they're all really good and do different things in just the right way. And if they can get those three playing together, I think it's really maybe one of the best midfields in the Premier League.
I'm nodding in agreement, which of course is not of great use on a podcast, but I go along with Barney. And in fact, what might work in Manchester United's favour here is because of this very strange transfer market that we're into. And, you know, obviously there have been all these rumours again, about Pogba and Juve and Real Madrid and even PSG at one point. But the way it's going, even if the transfer window is open until the 5th of October, which seems to be UEFA's ridiculous idea, it seems to be set and finally be in the kind of playing environment in which you can really see him having the kind of influence that he had, for example, for a French national team in 2018. And though, I mean, I'm not too sure what's going to happen till the end of this season, but I would already, if they can actually build on that, I would really look at Manchester United being a very strong contender for the 2020-2021 season if they can get that relationship going. And there's no reason why they couldn't. Absolutely none.
Well, I think they need a good striker as well. I think there's a problem there. Anthony Martial is not it. And Rashford is you know, he's getting better all the time, but that the strikers are not as good as the midfield. And also the Pogba is possibly, if he can just settle into playing, there's a really, really strange player. There's this kind of culture war about Pogba constantly where you have to take one opposition. These are absolutely brilliant or he's absolutely terrible. Whereas in fact, he's just like a good player. It's fine. Let him just be a good player. I saw somebody saying recently over the weekend, that he's a complete fraud and everything he's ever done is, you know, and then you get people responding by saying, oh, actually, he's won this, this and this. He's neither of those things. He's just a good player. It's really hard to understand why he's not allowed to just be decent at football.
Player who hadn't played since Boxing Day. He'd only played one half on Boxing Day. And that was that. Since then, his ankle injury had prevented him from playing any football. Pretty impressive, I must say.
I do feel that, you know, Spurs allowed, you know, Pogba to run that last half hour by getting deeper and deeper and deeper and putting 10 men behind the ball without an outlet because Harry Kane was clearly absolutely knackered. And it has been a problem of Tottenham
to never take Harry Kane off. It doesn't matter what's happening. It doesn't matter if he's scored a hat-trick and they're 8-0 up and they've got another game the next day. He'll still play 90 minutes. And Barry, I just didn't understand why Jose didn't take him off.
I didn't either. And it's funny, actually, because with the introduction of five substitutions, you would have thought Jose would be the man to sort of maximise that opportunity that's available to him. Harry Kane was clearly off the pace, clearly wasn't sharp, and quite why Jose didn't bring on, I don't know, a winger and shove Son up front baffled me. I mean, if that seems the obvious thing to do to me, surely it's the obvious thing for Jose to do. I mean, Tottenham's reliance on Kane, unnecessary reliance at times, I find baffling. I think it cost them the Champions League final last season, or certainly cost them a decent shot at it, their insistence on playing him when he clearly wasn't fit. It's weird, but I suppose they had no Dele Alli, no Lucas Moura available to them at the weekend, so that could be a factor. But they could have brought on... Sessegnon was on the bench, was he? He could have come on, move Son inside. But Jose elected not to do that.
Well, I think it's like a really interesting thing, this. I mean, there's two reasons for it. There's a historical thing in English football where some players simply... It's the barrack room hierarchy. You simply stay on the pitch. I did this thing about... I watched back England-Argentina from 98 over the lockdown period. And the thing about Shearer staying on the pitch, Shearer becoming England's attacker once Owen went off, it's the same thing. Like, we lost Owen when Beckham was sent off in that game because Owen went to play on the left wing and play left back, while Shearer had to stay at the front. The same thing happened with Kane against Croatia in the semi-final of the World Cup. We don't take off the leader. We don't take off the main man. That's like a built-in thing. And no one's ever had the balls to do it ever in the history of English football. So the other thing is we have the modern problem that some players are just in some ways bigger than their teammates. It's a celebrity issue. If you were to take Kane off, you then have to deal with the fact that Kane isn't necessarily happy to be taken off, and you have a big problem. You have people asking in your press conference. It's partly media and social media driven, and so these two things combine that you do have players now who simply can't be removed from the pitch without it being a political incident.
But would Jose Mourinho not strike you as the kind of guy who would have no truck with that kind of attitude?
What, you don't think Jose Mourinho believes in a hierarchy of beings and also in the power of celebrity?
Fair enough. It could be as well, if you're looking at a slightly, I mean, perverted way of looking at things, that in a way, by keeping him on the pitch, Jose Mourinho is yet again passing on the message, look, I've only got one striker and he's not fit. Give me another one, quick, please.
In all seriousness, I think what Mourinho would say is, who is more likely to win me this game now, Harry Kane or Ryan Sessegnon? That would be his point to you if you raise this in his press conference. And the fact is, he knows from watching these players in training and knowing them that the answer is Harry Kane, even if he looks really tired.
Can we talk about David De Gea? I mean, Stephen Bergwijn's shot was quite hard. And I sort of sometimes think goalkeepers get a little bit shortchanged when someone kicks a ball from quite close in really hard at them. He probably should have saved it. But do you think perhaps Barry Roy Keane was slightly over the top in his punditry?
He was completely over the top, but I suppose he's paid to be over the top. They don't give him presumably loads of money to come in and offer bland opinions, as some of their pundits do. David Gea should have saved that. If he got two hands to the ball, he should have kept it out. But he seems to have a crisis of confidence, or I suppose dating back to when Spain had a really bad World Cup and he was scapegoated for it to an extent. And he hasn't been the same since. I wouldn't say maybe his career is finished in the way that Joe Hart went. It seems to have gone into permanent decline since he had a bad World Cup with England. But David Gea is not playing well for Manchester United and hasn't played particularly well for them for some time.
To add to Barry's point here, when you look at the players whose mistakes have led to a goal, directly to a goal since the World Cup 2018 in the Premier League, David De Gea came in second position both in 2018-19 and 2019-2020. So, yes, there is a definite drop there in performance.
Is David Luiz at number one? Who's at number one?
No, it's not at number one. It's changed. I can tell you, usually keepers are unfortunately the ones who suffer the most from this type of... yes. So Asmir Begovic was number one for 2018-2019. And for 2019-2020, it's Martin Dubravka, who is top of the of that particular league.
Congratulations to Martin there.
Let's move on to Brighton Arsenal then. Brighton 2 Arsenal 1. Neil Mopar at the centre of everything, lovely goal, involved in that incident that injured Bernd Leno, kind of thrown on the floor by Guendouzi. Some great quotes at the end of the game. Barney, what did you make of Neil Mopar's day?
Oh, I don't think he did anything wrong. I mean, it's sometimes you when you bump into someone as they're off the ground, you know, their body doesn't adjust and they land badly. And I think that's what happened there. It wasn't a malicious or nasty challenge. But there's been this thing with Guendouzi, who seems to be the player who he then got into a kind of on-field slanging match with, or one of them anyway. And this has happened several times with Guendouzi. I mean, he's kind of, I wouldn't criticise this as a quality in a footballer, but he's basically a bit of a dick, I think, for want of a better phrase. He winds other players up, he gets stuck into them, which I kind of like and think is okay, as long as you can back it up with some good performances. But he sledges and he tries to upset other players and he talks crap on the field. And sometimes that will bounce back on you. And as Mope kind of said at the end, you know, sometimes you chat shit and you get banged. And I think that's what happened there. But I think it was good and it was passion. It shows that these players really want to play, you know. I quite enjoyed it.
Yes, here are the quotes. Some of the players need to learn what is humility. One of them was talking the whole game and saying really bad things. This is Mopai on Guendouzi. When I scored, I just had to say, listen, that is what happens when you say bad things on the pitch. Arsenal players maybe need to learn humility sometimes. They were talking a lot. They got what they deserved. It was a huge victory for Brighton. Gives them some real breathing space at the bottom. A question from Zach, though. What's something the panellists could say to make Arsenal supporters happy about football returning?
It's difficult to know what to say to give them any heart. I mean, Arsenal players took, well, most of them took a 12.5% pay cut at the start of the lockdown, and they seem to have sort of down tools by 12.5% as well. They still have players, that problem of players sort of running down their contract. Mesut Ozil is their highest paid player. He didn't take a pay cut. And I don't know if that has anything to do with his non-selection for their first two games or not. It's difficult to tell. The one thing I can give them hope for, I presumed that because he owns six major sports teams here and in the US, and that a lot of his money comes from retail, that Stan Kroenke might not have an arse in his trousers by the end of the whole pandemic. But I was doing a bit of homework, and according to the Billionaire Bonanza report, which was written by the Institute for Policy Studies, which is a Washington DC based think tank I'm sure you've all heard of, Stan Kroenke's wealth has actually increased by $400 million since the start of January, and his wife, who is a Walmart heiress, her wealth has increased by $120 million. So Arsenal fans who are worried that their owner might be going broke on the back of this pandemic don't need to worry about that. He's actually making loads of money. But whether or not he will invest it in Arsenal,
Barry,
remains to be seen.
But Barry, I think that you were going to say that for Arsenal fans, the great news would be Stan Kroenke would be obliged to sell. That I thought that was the great news. And you're telling me exactly the opposite. He's going to stick to it. Oh, dear.
All I'm saying is that he's not gone broke. I thought he might be, but okay. No, there's no danger of that.
I think Philip's right. I think him going broke is probably... But I mean, the problem for Arsenal is that the owner does not pump his own money into the club, but the income stream from match day revenue, it really is important. And that's just disappeared. So Arsenal and Spurs, more than anyone else, have found their plans completely ripped up by this. Whatever the business plan was, it was based around loads of people coming in and buying lots of wine and booze and nice sort of hospitality food in the stadium. And that's not going to happen anymore. I mean, at the moment, the only really good news you can offer Arsenal fans is about the resumption of football that is also going to stop quite soon. That's probably quite good news.
It's only a month. Let's do 2 minutes on Everton 0, Liverpool 0 before the end of part one. Only the third time this season Liverpool haven't won a Premier League game. It wasn't a classic. Tom Davis hitting the post late on. Everton could have snatched it, couldn't they? Albert says, can we talk about how bad Liverpool have been in the last 3 months of play, he says. Since Leicester in December, they've been coasting. Like Lewis Hamilton when he knows the race is over. I guess they haven't. You know, Wilson's written a piece, hasn't he? That they ground out 8 wins in a row. But I mean, that's not bad, is it?
My main takeout from that Wilson piece, and I suppose it's a measure of just how bad this game was that Wilson appears to think that people paint their ceilings with gloss paint, which is a terrible mistake because it's very shiny and it highlights any imperfections in your ceiling. You should really, Wilson, if you're listening, be using a matte or a texture, or even flexible paint, not gloss.
Wilson, if he does want a shiny ceiling, could use an eggshell emulsion, which will still roll on and is water soluble. But if he's glossing his ceiling, I fear for the lad. Just on Liverpool, I do think they're probably, as a really top team, unusually hit by what's happened in the last 3 months. They're not a team of stars. They don't have a player who's just going to walk onto the pitch and do something incredible because he's better than everyone else on the pitch. They rely entirely on what Klopp does with them on the training field and also on the feeling of how they play together and on a certain feeling of momentum, also on the crowd and just on playing an incredibly high pitch and by being physically relentless. And so the way they play is not going to immediately kick back in after 3 months off. They're hurt by this more than anyone else because they don't have a Messi type who'll just do something brilliant. So I think we probably can't really expect them to play at that pitch now.
The most interesting things from this game were the saxophonist I haven't heard this because I was listening with crowd noise, but apparently there was a saxophonist outside the stadium and like the sort of the blues was just sort of like the syncopated jazz was just flowing in because there was no other sound. Also, Everton making Liverpool change in a porter cabin made it very Sunday League. I enjoyed that.
I mean, Liverpool and Everton fans are probably going to be cross with us because we're not giving the game the attention they perhaps think it deserves, but it really was that terrible. I can't think of a single interesting thing to say about it. Everton's midfield was a bit lightweight. You know, that's it. But and Liverpool clearly missed Mo Salah and probably to a greater extent Andy Robertson. That's all I've got.
No, I think there are two valid points.
We should give some credit to Everton in that this was a sign that Carlo Ancelotti knows how to organise a team well. And they looked defensively well organised and stronger in midfield than they have under the last few fellows to occupy the same space.
And now City drop points against Burnley tonight. Liverpool can win the league against Crystal Palace at Anfield on Wednesday. Otherwise, it goes over to the next round of matches. And that'll do for part one. We'll begin part two at St James's Park. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Newcastle United 3, Sheffield United 0. William says, having seen them play so well in front of an empty stadium, are Newcastle fans regretting not having boycotted St James's Park when they had the chance? They'd be top of the league. Kazanaki says, are all of Newcastle United's problems entirely related to having to play in front of 50,000 Geordies shouting, you're fucking shite, at you every other week? Newcastle played quite well in this game and Sheffield United really didn't play very well. I mean, obviously, like, as is par for the course, the first half nothing happened apart from Joe Linton missed a chance, and then Sheffield United's defence just imploded, which is very unlike them, Vili.
Yes, I mean, they looked way off the pace. I was going to remark about Joe Linton. The last time I was on the pod, he just scored in a training game And we actually made a point of that. So maybe there is something happening here with him. I don't know. To be honest, it's a game that I lost a lot of interest in quite quickly. And I'm a little bit, when I hear about the Newcastle's performance, isn't that after the sending off? Because until then, they were not particularly brilliant. But Sheffield United looked very jaded, very heavy-legged, which is perhaps not... not unexpected. And I think it's probably one thing we've got to be quite careful about, because basically every single club has gone through a pre-season phase, and you never quite know the first couple of games how they're going to react to that. And it's, I wouldn't read anything much more than the fact that Sheffield United, you know, obviously looked jaded, they looked heavy-legged, and Newcastle, on the other hand, looked as if, I don't know, I mean, they looked like a team that actually was in decent form at the end of the game. But would you take any other, would you learn anything else from a game in which it was 11-10 after the longest preseason in the history of football? I don't necessarily think so.
Well, I agree with Philippe. And I also think that the same point I made about Liverpool probably applies to Sheffield United, who are a really well-drilled sort of systems team. They're not team that's brought a lot of expensive. They still got Billy Sharp playing up front, who's a really good player, but has learned to play a slightly different way under Chris Wilder. But they too need to play together and need to be at really peak levels to perform as well as they have been. And the break really didn't help them. I was interested to see Steve Bruce after the game, who, like, I don't really know why, but I always instinctively warm to Steve Bruce. I kind of like him, and I'd like to sort of be his friend and hang around with him, and, you know, maybe go on a long coach journey with him somewhere, and he'd be really cheerful and nice. And he's probably quite a good manager in this kind of situation, because I think the players probably quite like having him around. But I don't know if you noticed on Match of the Day, Philip Neville used the game to launch a sort of stinging attack on Rafa Benitez for some reason, comparing the comparative records of Rafa Benitez and Steve Bruce, which I'm not sure is kind of like for like, given the different teams and different times. But he was adamant that any new owner would be insane not to keep Steve Bruce on. And obviously, they're sort of very close friends, but it just struck me as the kind of punditry and analysis, what passes for analysis in this country, that just utterly sort of almost totally worthless. Like somebody talking about their friend in the game, and a man who seems to have his entire managerial career based on being a name himself, having friends, being a celebrity, using this very brief slot on Match of the Day to talk about his friend and his future job prospects. I thought it was extraordinary. I mean, no analysis whatsoever, just, I really like this guy. I don't know what the rest of the pod thought of that.
Well, I didn't see that, I must confess, but yeah, it does sound slightly odd. I mean, Steve Bruce was on a hiding to nothing going into that job, because he was taken over from Rafa Benitez. Anything he does well, there is a huge section of Newcastle fans who will bend, tie themselves in knots not to give him any credit for it. But if you look at his results, he's beaten Tottenham, beaten Manchester United, Chelsea, beaten Sheffield United, who everyone has been lauding, twice. In 16 games against top 10 sides, he's taken 21 out of 48 points. That's pretty decent, considering the team he's in charge of.
What was the bigger mistake, Barry? John Egan pulling back Joe Linton, who is very unlikely to score, or Ender Stevens managing to completely miss the ball, which is actually quite impressive just before Sam Maximam's goal?
I would say John Egan's first yellow card was probably the biggest mistake, because it was a very cheap one, and it ended up with him being sent off for getting the second one for a foul, which was probably also unnecessary. Joe Linton, he scored. He gets an awful lot of stick, much of it deserved, but I just think he's in a system that doesn't suit his style of play. It's not like he's some clown who won a competition to play for Newcastle for a couple of seasons. You know, he can play football, but it hasn't worked for him. Who knows, now that he's scored one, he may not have to wait another, 1,300 minutes of on pitch time to get his next one.
Aston Villa 1, Chelsea 2. Quite the turnaround. 2 goals in a couple of minutes for Chelsea. If you defend like that, staying up is going to be very tough, Barney. I just thought both those Chelsea goals were just so easy to score.
Yeah, they were. I mean, I suppose Pulisic made a good run for the first one. They'd just come on the pitch, so he wasn't picked up. In between those goals, I thought they actually defended quite well and looked okay, Aston Villa. They just, I mean, the second one was one of those goals that shouldn't really happen. It felt like it shouldn't really happen in professional football. It seemed too easy. It's the sort of goal that would happen in the kind of games that I play. Someone just has a shot and it goes in for some reason. I find the relegation area generally quite fascinating because there's four or five teams and you kind of think, well, two of these have to stay up. And I can't really work out who that's going to be because you look at quite a few of them and think, well, yeah, that looks like a team that might get relegated. I think Villa might have a decent chance still, though, because there is they have some decent players and I feel they could win games at some point.
West Ham 0, Wolves 2. Barney, you were there. I mean, Adama Traore is a joy. And as you said in your piece, he's just playing at a different shutter speed to everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, it helped that he came on after 60-odd minutes against tired players. And West Ham lack a bit of pace in their team as it is. But it's not just speed. He's got, you know, he's really in control of what he's doing. He's really good on the ball. And the cross for the first goal was the first moment of real quality in the game. And it was sensational. And yeah, West Ham just wilted completely. They seemed to, what was odd is at the end, David Moyes said, oh, we really struggled when Adama Traore came on and we didn't know what to do. And you kind of think, well, I don't know. I mean, if I were looking at Wolves, I'd think the first point one, what are we going to do when Adama Traore comes on would be kind of the first thing. And then you'd build from there. But he seemed astonished to find there was this very fast man in Wolves' team. And the second goal, in an empty stadium was just a thing of joy. If you could somehow capture that sound as it left, not just the sounds it left his foot, but the kind of whoosh noise as it hit the net, that was pure football. That was delicious.
Do you think there's a tactic of almost keeping one of your best players on the bench and bringing them on because players, certainly in these first few games, that people are, you know, are going to be quite tired? Barry?
Well, I was going to say there that I remember when Romelu Lukaku was on loan at West Brom years ago. That's what they used to do. They'd soften up the opposition centre halves. Then once they were knackered after about 70, 75 minutes, on would come Lukaku and just wreak havoc because they weren't able to contain him. And sort of with regard to what Barney said about you would think the first thing they would do is figure out how are we going to deal with Adama Traore, and I think like Lukaku back then at West Brom, it's a kind of a case of that Tyson quote about everyone having a plan until they get a smack in the mouth, and there's only so much you can do when players are that devastatingly effective.
It was quite interesting to hear Espirito Santo talk about the way he'd approached the game himself, as in he knew that he had a group of players who were not up to speed, and that he had deliberately set out in a particular way, which was all about organization to start with, all about some patterns, positional play and so forth. And then afterwards, yes, you can start to play. And he was quite happy with that. So again, which goes back to we are at a stage where it's extraordinarily difficult to judge on what teams are about and will be in 2-3 weeks' time. It's almost like basing what we think will happen to them on what we've seen, say, at the International Champions Cup in a normal season. It doesn't really make sense. But the thing is that, I mean, you had also, I mean, the thing you talk about preparing for Adama Traore, how much space had Jimenez got for his header? I mean, he was alone, wasn't he? I mean, there was social distancing to an extreme there. I mean, this was like 3 or 4 yards.
Did anybody like Lukas Fabianski's tweet after the game? Let me share screen with you. Mm-hmm. Can you see that? Here it is. It's very to the point. Lukas Fabianski, Wolves take 3 points, # West Ham, # COYI, with him taking a goal kick.
How bizarre.
I don't know, why would you do
all that? All it's missing is say something like.
But no,
it's accurate,
but
though, isn't it?
The, it's really accurate, but the PR man wouldn't say, perhaps send a tweet saying we lost today. It didn't make any sense at all, but I hope he continues to do that. As somebody below it just said, just pin the tweet, Lucas, and just change the opposition each time you play. Watford won, Leicester won. It didn't seem like a terrible game, but it only really sprang to life in the 90th minute, if that makes sense.
Well, I was going to say the goal from Ben Chilwell was incredible, wasn't it? It was like a goal from like the 1978 World Cup. It was one of those goals where someone... It was like a banana shot. You don't really see goals like that anymore. It was like a Brazilian left back in 1976. And he said, oh, you know, I just, people always say, have a shot. So I thought I'd have a shot. But it was an astonishing goal. And yeah, the angle was perfect. It totally, you know, unlike anything else in the game to that point.
It was great. Craig Dawson's finish was pretty good a couple of minutes later, wasn't it? His first Premier League goal in 31 appearances since February 2018. First ever in the Premier League for Watford. He said, you know, afterwards, not unlike Chilwell, he just said, yeah, I do that sometimes in training. But interestingly, me and Barry had Ben Foster on the radio yesterday who said, I've never seen him do that in training.
Just mentioning Ben Foster, did you see the angle of his face as the Chilwell goal flew into the top corner? His face was like, it's like this huge astonished look on his face. It's brilliant. That would make a fantastic still.
He said he knew as soon as it was hit that it was in. There was nothing he could do. The only other Premier League game in history to finish 1-1 with both goals in the 90th minute was Arsenal 1, Liverpool 1 in 2011. Arsenal's title hopes left hanging by a thread after they conceded a late penalty in an extraordinary finish against Liverpool at the Emirates. Bournemouth 0, Palace 2. Ben says, am I the only one disappointed with the lack of lockdown hair on display this weekend? I really wanted one player to have gone full Gandalf, complete with a you shall not pass aimed at the opposition. Well, if there is one man who has definitely not been to a hairdresser, it is Roy Hodgson. And didn't he look wonderful there?
He looked wonderful. He actually looked younger. Usually when people grow their hair, it makes them look older, but not with Roy. Roy had positive, he's shed, I mean, how many years has he shed? He looked wonderful. He's lost a bit of weight as well.
He looks kind of louche as well.
Yeah.
He looks like he played the bass in The Small Faces. And these days he's got a kind of residency somewhere on the French Riviera.
look, Palace, a lovely goal from Milivojevic. And they're having a great season, aren't they? And you know, after the game, Milivojevic was saying, look, most years we're looking behind us, but this season we get a chance to you know, look ahead and maybe push for Europe. And it would be a wonderful thing if Crystal Palace got into Europe.
Are you stating categorically, Max, that Palace are an outside shot for a Champions League place?
I'm stating nothing of the case. I'm just here to keep the conversation flowing, Barry.
You're a conduit.
Yeah, exactly.
I like Palace. They have some good players. They're having a great season, despite the fact that Wilf Zaha hasn't particularly fired for them this season as much as they would normally expect him to. Very sad news for Palace, actually. On Friday, Kayla the Eagle passed away.
Oh.
Anyone who's been to Sellers Park will have seen Kayla do her pre-match crossbar, her own little crossbar challenge where she swoops from one crossbar to the other. Very magnificent creature. With this enormous wingspan. Dom Fifield, formerly this parish, wrote a nice piece about her in The Athletic. And he recalled the day that she... Palace were playing Chelsea and the teams had come out, but Eden Hazard was sort of late out, dawdling out of the tunnel at Sellers Park down the corner. And he got the absolute fright of his life when Kayla the Eagle swooped down and sort of... buzzed him, I think is the term when you do it with an airplane. But he said it like it scared him so much that it actually affected his performance in the game.
But Hazard's quite small, isn't he? You could sort of see some kind of Lord of the Rings thing where Kayla could have come down and just picked Eden Hazard up and just flown off with him.
Well, anyway, poor old Kayla passed away on Friday from a heart attack. So RIP Kayla. I always found her to be a highlight of any trip to Palace, and sometimes the only highlight.
Finally, Norwich 0, Southampton 3. I thought Norwich were absolutely superb for the first 2 to 3 minutes of this game. But I was watching it. I was watching it thinking, wow, Southampton have not done anything all lockdown. They could lose this more than 9-0. I really thought for the first couple of minutes. And then, yeah, I've been saying for a long time that Norwich are the best, worst team ever in the Premier League. But are they actually just not very good, Barney?
Well, no, I really agree with you. I find it really hard to reconcile my feelings about Norwich because they're really fun to watch and they've got some really good players. And I really like the manager. He seems really sensible and nice and honourable. And yet, they're terrible and lose constantly. It doesn't seem to make any sense. And again, yeah, they just completely sort of collapse. They're very brittle. And at the end of these performances, the manager will explain in really reasonable, coherent detail why they're so brittle and bad and how it's not really a problem, but still they roll on. I don't see them necessarily winning the 8 games they require from here to escape relegation.
Well, he seems to think they only need 5 wins, which I suspect they won't win, and even if they did, might not be enough.
And there we are, relegated by Barry. Right, Man City play Burnley tonight. You mentioned Burnley releasing Joe Hart just before we finish part two. Sort of fascinating, quite sad demise of Joe Hart. And I saw someone put out a montage of him playing for City and being absolutely extraordinary and making... Okay, YouTube highlights can make any player look amazing, but making some really sensational saves.
The Real Madrid game.
Yeah.
He's genuinely had a career of two parts. So he really was good at one point. And I don't think he ever really... He had good seasons after that and good moments, but I don't think he really recovered from Euro 2012, personally. I mean, that seemed to be a turning point for him slightly. And he if you look at the number of games he's played in recently for various teams, and the number of clean sheets and the number of victories he's been involved in, it's extraordinary how many games as a professional player he's been involved in that are defeats. And it really has just dropped off a cliff. It's obviously some sort of crisis of confidence. But players don't... It doesn't often happen to players like this that you can just see the confidence drain out of them like that. It's quite... So people are a bit harsh on Joe Hart because he has at times seemed maybe a bit arrogant or very kind of confident, full of himself. But I think it's kind of sad what's happened there.
Was Euro 2012 when Andrea Pirlo made a fool of him? I think that was the moment, definitely. He tried to give it the big one and he just... Pirlo made an absolute idiot of
it. It seems a bit simplistic to just say it's that one moment. Maybe it is, but I don't know.
You're saying it's a simplistic analysis? I mean, it probably is. I don't think that's actually true. I don't think that moment sort of killed his career, but I think there are moments in something as so bound up in confidence as... not just football, but goalkeeping, where you can plant a seed of something. And he often seemed to be... Do you remember in Euro 2016, there was a site that used to publish fake quotes? And they were actually sometimes quite funny. And people would pick them up in the mainstream media and say, well, look, this has happened. There were some quotes about Joe Hart after the Iceland game where he had apparently been overheard saying... not understanding what the rules were, like we only need to lose to these, and saying we're too good, we're England, we can't possibly lose to this lot. And people sort of believed those quotes, and they were repeated until it was pointed out they're from a fake site, and they were so ridiculous. But at that point, he seemed kind of not entirely in control of himself, and it was kind of believable. I think sometimes goalkeepers could benefit from being dropped in their careers, and maybe he needed to be dropped at some point or to take stock of it earlier.
Isn't it the case of somebody who caught the right wave very early on and found himself going up, up, up alongside with Manchester City, which in fact was too big a club for him from the start, but doing rather well. And then afterwards, you can only crash down and then acquiring all this confidence, thinking he was, number one, England number one and so forth, but perhaps not being quite good enough for, well, that's certainly what Pep Guardiola thought, didn't he? And because of that, when this is taken away from you, when the wave has crashed, you find yourself, well, without much to look forward to. And the next wave is not going to come if you're a professional footballer arriving at that stage of your career.
Also, I believe the last person to ever hand me a Jaeger bomb.
Maybe that began his decline.
Quite possibly. His handling was absolutely perfect on that occasion.
Was it just before the game against Italy?
And that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll chat to Ben Fisher, the Guardian's Football League correspondent. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. The Championship is back as well. The other best league in the world. Let's talk to the Guardian's Football League man, Ben Fisher. Ben, how are you?
Yeah, good. You okay, Max?
Yeah, very good. Thanks. So the Leeds burnout begins.
Yeah, it was pretty spectacular as well in a way. I mean, Cardiff really, really got in amongst them and made life difficult. And Leeds, to put it simply, just did not like it. They couldn't find a way around it. And yeah, not the start they were after.
We don't seriously think that they can mess it up from here, though. I mean, they are, what, 7 points clear of Fulham in third?
Yeah, it would take quite a serious implosion now, but next Saturday's game at home to Fulham is a biggie now. The thing is, it could have been even bigger if Fulham hadn't slipped up against Brentford, so they must be kicking themselves as well. So Leeds, in a way, kind of got off the hook. But yeah, all to play for.
Ben, could I just briefly go back to Leeds? I didn't think they played that badly. Admittedly, I wasn't watching the game closely. I was keeping an eye on it in the radio studio. But it just seemed to be the problem, the usual problem, of not having someone to finish.
Yes, on another day, I think Patrick Bamford probably helps himself to a couple of goals and Leeds are, you know, on their way. But it didn't happen. Obviously, blocked the one where Jack Harrison is probably going in. I think, to be fair, credit to Cardiff, because I think people will probably make snide remarks about them. But I think they actually did a bit of a job on Leeds, and Leeds ultimately could not do anything about it. Bielsa was roaring on the side again, but it couldn't do anything about it.
Ben, there's a lot of chat about Patrick Bamford being sort of not very good at scoring goals and it being a big problem. Is that chat fair? I mean, or because I've always sort of liked him as a footballer. He's got a lovely touch, and you know, he seems quite graceful.
Yeah, I think to be fair, he does a lot of good work. And yesterday, it was just kind of fine margins, that old kind of maxim, really. He's played through a couple of times, should have done better with a couple, no doubt about that. And the one where he blocks on the line, you know, he's probably a bit powerless, really. Another time, that just goes in. So I think a lot of managers, and Bielsa himself, has lauded his work rate, and Bielsa really likes him. So I don't think there's any possibility of changing that up. And also, Leeds don't really have the personnel to really do so.
West Brom drew 0-0 at home to Birmingham. And we've talked quite a lot already about how the Premier League games weren't all classics. The Championship players had less time to get ready for the comeback. Did it generally look sort of tired and laboured, or was it more interesting than that?
I think there's a bit of a mixed bag. I think certain teams really state their claim. West Brom, Birmingham, yeah, wasn't a classic. But you look at Swansea and they've sort of really come to life, and they're one of those teams, I think 3 points separate 6-7 teams that are chasing the playoffs. And there's quite a few that if they can just click into gear, they'll really fancy their chances of sort of gate crashing that sixth place. But West Brom, another team, they just don't want to make life easy. It's a bit like Leeds. And, you know, who's actually going to go and sort of do it in the end?
You mentioned that Fulham-Brentford game. I mean, Brentford, what, two late goals? Was it smash and grab, or did they deserve that?
I actually thought Brentford just sort of took their time, and then when the opportunities presented themselves, they were ruthless. Nice to see Said Benrahma sort of be involved, obviously get the goal. Emiliano Marcondes, brilliant, sort of inspired substitution by Thomas Frank. And I actually think Fulham have a lot to do if they're to, I don't know, that they seem a long way off where they need to be. And I think that could actually, in the end, that could be the biggest helping hand for Leeds, because Fulham, realistically, the only team that can danger that sort of top two. And Fulham don't really look like they've got the gumption to do it.
Is Brentford getting promotion the fairy tale? Is that who we should all be backing for, like, the dream story?
Yeah, and I think for the neutrals, it'd be brilliant, just because they play some absolutely brilliant stuff as well. No doubt if they got promoted, they'd earn a few more fans. But I think if they were to do it, it'd have to be through the playoffs, Max. I think it's just too much to do, too big a gap to close.
And what about the bottom? It's tight down there, and there's some big teams you might drop.
Yeah, it's ludicrously tight. I think it gets overlooked. I think it looks a bit of a foregone conclusion, but it's anything but. And the point I would like to make is that actually, I think it's further evidence of how cruel PPG is in Leagues 1 and Leagues 2, really, because actually Charlton, they beat Hull on the weekend, and suddenly now, if the season was stopped tomorrow, Hull would go down and Charlton wouldn't on unweighted PPG. So just goes to show. And yeah, very, very tight. Stoke, Huddersfield, Middlesbrough, you know, big clubs. I think, yeah, a bit sort of squeaky bum time for a few of them.
There was a lot of late goals in the Championship. I don't know if it's just coincidence, but very, very late equalisers, winners, whatnot. And I was curious, actually, to get everyone's thoughts on this. Home advantage in behind closed door stadiums. There was 23 games across the Premier League and Championship since I think we restarted. We've had, and out of those 23, 5 home wins, 10 away and 8 draws. Is home advantage no longer a thing?
So basically, this chimes in with the stats we have from the Bundesliga.
I mean, there's no doubt that any kind of home advantage is completely removed by this. So I know it's hardly as though West Ham is like a cauldron of intimidating noise at the best of times. And quite frankly, often that's turned on their own board, if not the players. But the atmosphere was so thin at the London Stadium. And, you know, there's nothing to intimidate you. There's nothing to fight against.
I mean, it's a real question. I mean, does it mean that it's far more difficult to adapt to a situation where you don't have a public and you're used to have a public and therefore you play perhaps a more positive game? The public is not there and you don't quite have the nous, the know-how or the mental awareness to slightly change your approach of it, or you don't know what to do. And the people who are visiting are sticking to their, you know, usual strategy and they're picking the results, which is very strange.
You have a muscle memory of playing a certain way in those and expecting a certain response in those situations. Whereas as an away team, you often take the game as you find it. You don't come with a preconceived idea of how you should start, how it's going to feel. I think possibly it's harder for the home team rather than easier, as it usually is.
Ben, you mentioned PPG and the sort of whether it's fair or unfair, explain what's happened at the bottom of League Two, because I was under the mistaken impression that Stevenage were going to be safe for a long time.
Yeah, well, it doesn't look like they no longer are, really. Because of Macclesfield, they only got a 2-point deduction, so Stevenage look like they're going to go down after all. I think technically that could still be appealed by the EFL, so that there could potentially be another twist in the tail, though very unlikely, I think, now, because any further sanction would roll into next season. Stevenage are not too happy about it, and I believe they're considering sort of going down the legal route, as are, I believe, Tranmere. Although Peterborough and Darren McAntony, I think, now are just so exhausted with it all in League One, they've given up that aspect of it. But yeah, safe to say, quite a few of those clubs not too happy.
Tonight is the League Two playoffs. We had the first legs on Thursday. Colchester 1-0 up as they go to Exeter. Cheltenham 2-0 up, they host Northampton. Who's going to go up out of those four, Ben?
I think I fancy a Cheltenham definitely to get through to the final. And Exeter at home, I know we were just saying about home advantage, but I'd like to think Exeter could turn things around. I think Cheltenham are definitely the best team out of that pack. Michael Duff done a brilliant job, spent his sort of coaching education under Sean Dyche at Burnley. Some of his team play really good football. And also, we had Shaq O'Neill at Northampton. Now we're going to have Phil Mitchell, Cilla Black in a few of the Cold War Steve cast at Warden Road. So that's something to look forward to, if nothing else.
Ben, thanks for your time. We'll get you back on soon.
Thanks a lot. Cheers, guys.
Now, Philippe, you send me a long list of exciting things to talk about. I've no idea how long the pod is already. So I'm happy for you to list them and they may well make the edit. They may well not.
You can say maybe yes or no. So if you want any development, you say yes or no. So I just say the thing and you say, actually, that's quite interesting.
Okay. So I'm going to leave it to, I think Barney is the one, because he's got a gardener coming who's under the most time pressure. So it's up to Barney. Philippe, suggest something. Barney, you choose if you want to hear more or not.
Okay, so item number one, 10th anniversary of the French team strike in Knysna, South African World Cup 2010.
Barney, would you like to hear that?
Well, I kind of would, but I'm also sensing it might not be a kind of a top tip-top headline right now.
Okay.
Number two.
French government announcing that sports should be resuming in mid-August, hey, with crowds of up to 5,000 people.
Yeah, that's a yes.
Well, off you go, Philippe.
Yeah, well, it's all the more interesting since you remember that the Edouard Philippe, the French prime minister, said, that's it, the season is cancelled, blah, 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 and all the crisis it has triggered. But I'm wondering if it actually couldn't work to the benefit of French football and Ligue 1, because we might be in a situation where Ligue 1 actually starts when it was supposed to start, sort of mid to late August, with crowds. So I'm actually wondering if it couldn't be a blessing in disguise and make the decision, which everybody thought was harebrained, of stopping the season, actually look a little bit better than seems the case at the moment.
And Philippe, now that the season has started here and in Spain and in Italy and blah, 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 are people in France still going, what the hell?
Yeah.
Why did we move to finish?
Yeah, they are at the moment. They are at the moment. And an awful lot of people saying, well, it's a proof that there is no real football culture in France. It's the proof the government doesn't care about football. It's the proof that Ligue 1 really is the worst league in the world. We're not part of the five big leagues in Europe. That's not the case anymore. So there's a lot of... And on top of that, of course, you've got the fact that a court has decided that the relegation of Amiens and Toulouse was unlawful. And therefore, we have a situation, we have absolutely no idea at the moment what's going to happen in terms of who's going to go down, who's going to go up. So it's one big mess. But the silver lining is the fact that, yeah, we could have football games resuming in August for the new season with crowds in the stadiums. That would make a huge difference.
And that would be before the Champions League latter stages start, which would really
to be honest, the dates are not completely set in stone yet, but what is sure is that the French league would probably have a head start on every other league in Europe and for the return of real football, if you see what I mean. So that could be interesting. So that was item number one.
Yes, Philippe, I'm going to give you one more, and okay, you can either talk about the watch or Michel Platini.
It's a tough call, guys. Story one, Michel Platini is saying Qatar should be stripped of the World Cup if found guilty of corruption. Item two is the PSG president, Nasser Al-Khelaifi, sending a 40 grand watch to Jérôme Valk for thanking him for his role in moving the World Cup to winter, allegedly. Allegedly. So you've got the choice between those two. Which one would you prefer?
Well, Philip, these are the same story, aren't they? I mean,
not really.
Does anyone care what Michel Platini says anymore? Isn't he very much...
Okay, I'll take it that as you want number two, which is funnier, because what is great is that Nasser Al-Khelaifi, this is all part of a phone intercepts published by the French website Mediapart, sends a watch worth 40 grand, which is a Cartier skeleton. If you want to have a look at it, it's really ugly. Valk is really happy, texts back saying, I'm so happy, thank you very much, you're such a friend to me. And then texts him back 15 minutes later saying, Nasser, the warranty in the box, that's for the wrong watch. So I think you've understood everything about Jérôme Valk when you hear that little story.
Philippe, thank you so much. I love that.
You're very welcome.
That'll do for today. Thank you for your time, Barney.
Cheers, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Philippe.
Thank you very much.
And we will be back tomorrow. Archie Rintutt, Nicky Bandini, and hopefully Sid, if he replies to his WhatsApp.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.